Radio.
This is the people's war. It is our war. We are the fighters. Fight it then. Fight it with all that is in us. And may God defend the right.
Warning, warning.
We've got to stop them. They're going to kill us all.
See how the trouble you've started?
Be they the government, be they industry, be they organized labor, be they anyone. Or human beings.
Time when the operation of the machine becomes so orient, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Revolution Radio of FreedomSlips.com, the number one listener-supported talk radio station, throwing ourselves upon the gears of the machine. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
You called down the thunder, well now you got it.
Red, you tell them I'm coming, and hell's coming with me, you hear? Hell's coming with me!
Revolution Radio!
Insanity runs in my family.
Practically gallops.
No stems, no seeds that you don't need. Acapulco Gold is
this is Jake, the most action I've ever seen in my life. Wow, man.
Fire it up, hold up.
Why don't you get a job for Coley?
What for?
You need money.
All I need are some tasty waves, cool buzz, and I'm fine.
Welcome and thanks for tuning in to Revolution Radio. And now it's time for that feral hippie herself, an infotartic, esoteric, eclectic mix of the adventures of that feral hippie, Miss Mona Radler.
What are you people? On dope?
That was my skull! I'm so wasted!
Make a move and the money gets in.
Dave's not here!
All right, Mona, it's all yours. Take it away.
Okay, I made it. Welcome. FreedomSlips.org, Revolution.radio. 20th day of November, 2021. We are here, listener supported. So please do us that favor. Hook us up so we can stay on air. Yes, please. I truly do appreciate it. Thank you. Okay.
In the world's poorest countries, around one in four children are engaged in child labour.
The world's biggest food company, Nestle.
A Nestle company.
Nestle.
Nestle collects millions of gallons a year from springs in Southern California.
Did you agree with me that your product should not be used where there is impure water?
They are taking the water that should not be owned by anybody.
Using indentured servants in parts of Asia, of using child slave labor in parts of Africa. They've been trying to steal water everywhere from Brazil to Flint, Michigan. When it comes to corporations operating without any regard to human health and safety, the Nestle Corporation really seems to be in a league all of its own. What's going on with this company?
Nestlé is the largest food and beverage corporation in the entire world. They own over 2,000 different brands and sell chocolate, cereal, coffee, baby food, water, ice cream, and so much more. In fact, it would be difficult to go shopping and not buy something that's owned by Nestlé. And yet, the company is accused of some truly horrific things, including child slavery, killing babies, exploiting the poor, claiming water shouldn't be a human right, and countless other scandals. So, what's the truth? And if Nestlé really is this evil, how are they getting away with it? This video is a journey into the dark world of Nestlé, a look behind the curtain at one of the most controversial companies ever. But to understand the story of Nestlé, we first need to go back to the man who started it all. The story of Nestlé begins with the birth of a boy in Frankfurt in 1814. Henry Nestlé was the 11th of 14 children and was born into a family of glaziers, where the trade of cutting and fitting glass had been passed down from father to son for many generations. However, as Henry got older, he became fascinated with chemistry and decided he wanted to become a pharmacist instead of going into the family trade, which caused a bit of a rift between him and his dad. But Henry was determined to follow his own path, and at 15, he began working as a pharmacist's apprentice before later leaving his hometown in Germany to go and live in Switzerland, where he worked on concocting medicines and chemical experiments. It was here in Switzerland that Henry would start one of the biggest corporations in the world. In fact, to this day, Vevey in Switzerland remains the headquarters of Nestlé. But it wasn't until much later in his life that Henry started Nestlé. Before his big break, Henry tried all kinds of different entrepreneurial ideas. Like, he started producing and selling liqueurs, vinegars, rum, lemonade, and even fertilizers. But none of his business ideas ever seemed to take off. It wasn't until Henry was in his 50s that he finally had his big breakthrough. It all began when Henry read a report that infant mortality had become extremely high because many women couldn't breastfeed their children or their children were allergic to the milk. Henry realized this massive problem was also a big opportunity. There was clearly a major need for an artificial alternative to breastfeeding that could save countless babies' lives. And thus, Henry began to study all the existing information about breast milk and conduct a series of experiments in his lab with various different ingredients. But saving children's lives wasn't the only thing that pushed Henry day and night to find a breast milk substitute. His own tragedy also played a part, as Henry's wife had had many health issues of her own, and thus was unable to give birth. So as a way to channel her maternal instincts, she became extremely concerned about other people's babies and pushed Henry to create a breast milk substitute that could save lives. And by 1867, he'd succeeded. Henry had created one of the first ever baby formulas, essentially a formulated mixture of cow's milk, flour, and sugar, which could be a substitute to natural breast milk. Henry then created a company called Nestlé to begin selling it. And so you see, Nestlé began with such great intentions, a humble guy creating a life-saving product for babies who couldn't breastfeed naturally. Unfortunately, this isn't a heartwarming success story. If anything, this is a horror movie. You see, whilst baby food was the product that started Nestlé's dominance, it was also the product that would later destroy lives and create an international scandal. And as Nestlé grew into a giant conglomerate, they became shrouded in all kinds of dark controversies. But we'll get to that. At first, Henry's new baby formula was a big success. Orders were coming in so quickly that Henry had to open up a factory to keep up with the demand. He couldn't believe it. Everything was happening so fast and money was pouring in. With the huge success of this first product, Henry then partnered with a Swiss chocolatier to create another new product. And in 1875, they created the first chocolate milk. In the space of just a couple of years, Henry went from being a small, unknown pharmacist in Switzerland to one of the richest men in the country. And Nestlé was growing more and more every month. But, in a way, it was all a bit too much for Henry, who was entering the final stages of his life and wanted to relax and spend more time with his wife. And so, a few years later, Henry decided to retire and sell his company. And this is where things get really interesting. You see, the new owners who took over Nestlé had big plans to expand the company. And in 1905, they merged with a rival business who sold similar products called Anglo-Swiss. And together, they became known as the Nestlé Group. By pooling all their resources together instead of competing, it allowed them to more easily dominate the market and expand their product lines. By the 1920s, Nestlé was creating new chocolates and different beverages. And by 1938, they'd created the first mass-market coffee. Their timing was great, as instant coffee helped keep soldiers awake during the Second World War, and thus it became included in all emergency rations of every US soldier. As well as creating new products, the Nestlé group quite often just acquired other companies they saw potential in, or that they thought could be serious competition. And so, as the years went by, Nestlé's list of products grew and grew, and so did their wealth and power. Unfortunately, that wasn't enough for them. And behind the scenes, a plan was being hatched. A plan that would make millions of dollars, but risk millions of lives. When Henry Nestlé first created his baby formula back in 1867, the whole idea was a supplement to help mothers who couldn't breastfeed their children, certainly not to try and replace breast milk altogether. And the reason for that is studies have shown that natural breast milk is healthier than any formula. Natural breast milk is widely recommended by the World Health Organization, American Medical Association, UNICEF, and countless others. So for a while, baby formula was sold simply as an alternative for those who needed it. But in the 1970s, roughly 100 years after the company first began, sales seemed to be slowing down, and Nestlé started to get greedy. They wondered, what if we could sell this baby formula to all mothers, not just those who actually need it? You see, despite all the other products Nestlé had launched, baby formula was still one of Nestlé's biggest money makers, and that's because it has very high profit margins. So imagine how much more money they could make if they could expand their market to all mothers. So Nestlé began a campaign to undermine breast milk, and aggressively advertised their baby formula as being superior, manipulating mothers into believing Nestlé's formula was a necessity for the health of their babies, and that it would be better for their child than breastfeeding, when in reality, the evidence was the opposite. Nestlé's formula was vastly inferior to natural milk, as it lacked many of the nutrients that helped babies fight off disease and keep them healthy. By encouraging mothers to switch when they didn't need to, it was putting their babies at a higher risk of infection and malnutrition. In order to make sure mothers believed this information, though, Nestlé began paying off doctors and hospitals to peddle their formula by asking them to tell mothers it was better than breastfeeding. Nestlé then ramped this up further in Africa and Asia, where they would hire saleswomen to dress up like nurses and convince mothers to give up breastfeeding and use their formula instead. These saleswomen were paid on commission, meaning the more formula they sold, the more money they made, thus encouraging them to sell the formula very aggressively. Which they did. These saleswomen, posing as genuine nurses, would walk the halls of maternity wards, or even visit mothers at their homes unannounced and sell them on Nestlé's baby formula. And it gets much worse. Nestlé got these fake nurses to hand out free samples of their formula to mothers. Except, they gave them just enough samples that by the time the samples ran out, the mothers would have stopped producing milk naturally, and thus had no choice but to pay for Nestlé's expensive product to keep their child alive. This proved to be very successful and profitable for Nestlé, and so they expanded this plan to many other locations, but especially developing nations, where many of the women weren't educated enough to know the information they were being fed wasn't true. After all, if a woman who appears to be a qualified nurse is telling you that your baby needs this product, you're just gonna believe them. Of course, the consequences were fatal. It's estimated millions of babies died or were made severely deficient in essential nutrients because of this. The worst impact was in third world countries where there was no access to clean water. The big problem was that the baby formula had to be mixed with water, and yet Nestlé was convincing people they needed to use this baby formula in places where clean water was in very short supply. So the formula was getting mixed with water that was polluted and contaminated, thus making the babies ill. To make matters even worse, because many of these women couldn't afford to keep buying the baby formula that their babies now depended on, they instead diluted it with even more water, which meant that the babies didn't get enough of the nutrients they needed from the formula, leading to malnutrition. It didn't help that the instructions on the packaging were in English, which most of the mothers in these countries couldn't read, so they didn't even realize that by diluting it so much, they were starving their children. This also meant many of them didn't know they needed to boil the water first to prevent bacteria making their baby sick. For a while, Nestlé did nothing about any of this, and seemed to be getting away with it all. But then in 1974, a publication entitled The Baby Killer specifically called out the serious consequences of aggressively pushing baby formula in these countries. Nestlé was listed for its involvement in creating a need that didn't exist before, then convincing consumers the product was necessary, and then getting them hooked on it, all whilst completely ignoring the tragic consequences. When this was translated into German by Swiss campaigners, it was given the very blunt title, Nestlé Kills Babies, which led to Nestlé taking legal action against them. But it was all too late. All this coverage created an international scandal for Nestlé, and boycotts were launched against them in numerous countries. Despite this, the company remained quiet on the issue. However, they couldn't run from this. In 1978, Nestlé executives were brought before the US Senate for questioning about the impact of Nestlé's formula milk on all of these sick or dying infants. And soon after, new regulations were introduced by the World Health Organization that said companies couldn't compare breast milk with formula milk alternatives in their ads. Whilst this helped in well-regulated countries, in much of Southeast Asia and the Pacific, the regulations and laws were not so well enforced, meaning Nestlé doubled down on their marketing in many of these underdeveloped countries with less restrictions, and thus their sales continued to increase. Meanwhile, back in places like the US, where sales had stalled, Nestlé tried to change their tarnished image and promote breast milk by using some very bizarre ads featuring something called the Super Babies. The idea was to try and distance themselves from the negative media attention they'd received by making out like they'd totally changed, despite the fact they were still using the same exploitative tactics to push their formula in countries where they could still get away with it. Even as recently as 2018, a report by Save the Children found the health of millions of vulnerable children were being put at risk because of the aggressive marketing tactics used by Nestlé and several other giant corporations. And yet, despite all of the extremely serious problems their tactics have caused, I'm sorry to say that when it comes to Nestlé's dark past, we're only just getting started. In 2005, the Nestlé CEO implied that having access to water wasn't a basic human right.
Das Wasser zu einem öffentlichen Recht erklärt wird. Das heißt, als Mensch sollten Sie einfach Recht haben, Wasser zu haben. Das ist die eine Extremlösung.
After the media criticized him for this, he later backtracked. But to see how he really feels, we can simply look at Nestlé's actions when it comes to water. For example, in Pakistan in 2013, Nestlé began diverting clean drinking water away from villages and towns, and then began bottling it in their factories, and selling it back to the same people they took the water from, but at a much, much higher price. The big issue is that Nestlé had taken so much water that thousands were forced to drink dirty sludge water instead, because these people couldn't afford to buy the expensive bottled water, which, remember, was theirs to begin with. Nestlé's strategy was essentially to deprive people of a necessity like clean water, and then supply them an expensive alternative. Since Nestlé arrived in the country, there are claims they have sucked the land dry, and caused water levels to sink hundreds of feet. And it's not just in developing countries where Nestlé does this. For example, in America, when California was suffering from droughts, many companies moved their operations out of the state. But not Nestlé. In the midst of this very serious water shortage, Nestlé Waters continued to pump 705 million gallons of fresh water from California's national parks, draining some of the state's remaining water resources to sell back to Californians. And when asked about this, the Nestlé Waters CEO said that if he could bottle more of California's water for profit during the drought, he would. Likewise in Michigan, it was reported Nestlé pumped 747 liters of fresh water every minute out of the state's reserves, and that Nestlé pays only $200 to take 130 million gallons of Michigan's water. After Nestlé caused a drastic reduction in the state's water levels, a judge eventually ordered Nestlé to stop its operations due to the ecological harm they were causing. Whilst it's perhaps not widely known, the reality is Nestlé has the largest bottled water operation in the world, and owns over 50 brands of bottled water. So Nestlé are actually incentivized to target places with limited clean water available from their own natural resources, because if they buy up lots of the natural water supplies and create a shortage, it creates massive demand. If you've seen Mad Max Fury Road, you may remember the guy who was hoarding all the water, and that's not too dissimilar from Nestlé's approach. But perhaps where Nestlé got a lot of their inspiration was the classic British show Only Fools and Horses. In one episode, the characters decide to sell bottled water by claiming it came from a natural spring, when really it just came straight out of the tap. Now, this show was a comedy, but Nestlé decided to basically do that in real life. Nestlé has simply bottled up water that comes from the exact same municipal supplies as tap water and advertised it as coming from Clear Mountain Springs, thus allowing them to add a huge markup to the price. When, in fact, they can buy a tank of this water for $10, use it to fill thousands of plastic bottles, and resell this glorified tap water for an estimated $50,000. Before we get to the next chapter, can we all just agree that traditional education is broken? Memorizing a textbook for an exam or listening to someone lecture you for hours is not the most effective way to learn, and it's not enjoyable either. Which is why I want to tell you about today's video sponsor, Brilliant. If you want to learn genuinely useful skills like coding or problem solving, then honestly, Brilliant is the perfect way to learn. They have thousands of online lessons on specific skills, and I love how interactive they are, because this kind of hands-on learning is just way better. Like, I'm planning on doing a documentary on artificial intelligence soon, and I've been going through their course on neural networks, and even though it's a complex topic, they may have been found to use forced labor and even corruption if you go to brilliant.org/. When you pick up a chocolate bar, probably the last thing on your mind is how that chocolate bar was made. But the brutal truth is that Nestlé has been found to use forced labor and even child slavery on the farms where the cocoa beans are harvested. And for a while, this cheap exploitative labor went mostly unnoticed, leading to low costs and high profits. But then in the year 2000, a report came out that said Nestlé was guilty of buying blood chocolates, and that Nestlé was fully aware that enslaved children were working on their plantations. Now, this was also true for many of the big chocolate companies. So in the year 2000, Nestlé, Cadbury, and Mars all promised to make their chocolate slave-free by 2005. Except, they didn't. The years flew by, and they kept missing all the deadlines they set. In fact, in 2005, the International Labour Rights Fund filed a lawsuit against Nestlé and other chocolate manufacturing companies on behalf of 3 Malian children, alleging the children were trafficked to the Ivory Coast, forced into slavery, and frequently beaten on the chocolate plantation. Nestlé's response to incidents like this was always the same. They said it was impossible to keep track of everything going on these plantations, but they vowed to try and improve the situation. But then a few more years passed, and it seemed like nothing had really changed. In 2010, a documentary called The Dark Side of Chocolate brought attention to the media about how children were being stolen away from their homes and families and being forced to work on plantations for very little or no money at all. Then an investigation in 2020 discovered that children as young as 8 were picking coffee on the farms of one of Nestlé's suppliers. It was reported children worked 7 days a week, carrying sacks that weighed twice their weight, and got paid around $1 an hour for their work. However, once again, Nestlé denied knowledge of this and said they tried to fix it. And to be fair here, this is a complex issue that's certainly not limited just to Nestlé. But what does seem clear is Nestlé have known about these labor problems for decades, and with their billions of dollars, they could surely have done a lot more if they really wanted to. The only time they seemed to show signs of action against these brutal working conditions was when they were getting negative press. And there's another example of this with what happened in Ethiopia. In 2002, Nestlé was demanding $6 million from the government of Ethiopia, one of the poorest countries on the planet. The conflict dated back to the 1970s, when a military regime in Ethiopia seized all the assets of foreign companies and nationalized them. And then, many years after this, one of those companies that had its assets seized was acquired by Nestlé, who were now demanding compensation. Now remember, this was a business that was nationalized under a different government 27 years ago, and a business which Nestlé didn't even own at the time. But still, to be fair to Nestlé here, technically they were entitled to claim compensation. But here's the issue. At the time they were making this demand for $6 million, Ethiopia was facing an extreme famine that threatened the lives of 15 million people. The country was in extreme poverty, with many citizens making less than $100 a year. That $6 million could help provide clean water to millions of Ethiopians. It could quite literally save lives. But despite being aware of this, and despite the fact Nestlé made around $65 billion in sales that same year, Nestlé initially refused to let Ethiopia off the hook, and persistently demanded the money. Even though $6 million $1 was nothing to Nestlé. They said it was the principle of the matter that was important. However, once the media picked the story up and people started threatening to boycott Nestlé, they immediately did a U-turn and settled the debt for $1.5 million instead and vowed to reinvest it into the country's economy. But it seems pretty clear if it wasn't for the potential PR nightmare, they had no intention of backing down. And if you thought Nestlé's controversies ended there, think again. In 2012, the Competition Bureau raided the offices of Nestlé to investigate price fixing, claiming Nestlé was making deals with other chocolate companies to ensure they all kept their prices equally high so they didn't undercut each other and give customers a better deal. Nestlé denied any collusion, but eventually settled for a $9 million settlement the following year. Ordinarily, this might be quite a big controversy, but in the context of everything else they've been accused of, it doesn't even seem that bad comparatively. And to be honest, we could go on for a while listing allegations against the company, like the legal dispute that claimed dog food produced by Nestlé Purina Pet Care resulted in serious illness and death of thousands of dogs, or we could talk about Nestlé's terrible pollution stats. But here's the thing, because of all these scandals Nestlé have been involved in, many people have tried to boycott Nestlé products. But the company is so vast that it's incredibly difficult because there's just so many different products they sell. They have reach in almost every country with products in so many different categories. When you buy food, water, or even cosmetics, without realizing it, you may be buying from a Nestlé brand. Which is probably why, despite all of these controversies, Nestlé has continued to grow and make more acquisitions to become even more powerful. And to be fair, I'm sure there are many people working at Nestlé who just want to make good products in a perfectly ethical way. The issue is that when Henri Nestlé founded the company, he was solving a very genuine problem. But unfortunately, as Nestlé grew, their business model later started creating problems instead, so they could sell you the solution. Of course, when you've been around for hundreds of years and own so many brands, I guess some scandals are kind of inevitable. Just ask Coca-Cola. To see the disturbing history of Coke, just click right here. I'll hopefully see you there. Cheers.
How sad is that? I mean, really.
There. Cheers.
It's not going to let me go there. Who is this? Well, that's mine. Okay. Oh, we're done with that. Oh, then we're done with that. Break!
If you're not in control, then someone else is. Join me, Ivy West, for Voices on the Wind, Saturday. I discuss government, health, metaphysics, suppressed science, universal mysteries, little-known incredible facts, alternative energies, and even more than you can imagine. Won't you join us on Revolution Radio Saturdays? For Voices on the Wind, with me, Ivy West.
There are lives in the balance, people under fire, children at the cannons. There are...
Because if your head's in the sand, your tail is a target.
The Secret Kindergarten is here for the young children of the world. The best program on the radio for kids, dealing with the most important topics in the whole universe. Fairy tales, music and movement, numbers, plants, animals, fun, colors, insects. Take care and cast your ears out to catch a story from the world of other young things, reach out, up, under, and over. Sing a song. Talk about feelings. Just remember the magic word. The magic word is no. Step on into the secret kindergarten. Saturdays, 2 p.m. to 3 p.m. Eastern Time, right here on Revolution Radio.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the Internet. Please help support this station so this battle can continue forward. Revolution Radio!
Join me and the Brian Ruse Show on Revolution Radio, Eastern Standard Time, every Tuesday night from 6 to 8. We talk about the four most vital things, in my view, affecting all of humanity. Number one is UFOs and aliens and their agenda for the advancement of humanity. Number two is the Jewish establishment's control over all aspects of human civilization. Number three, the truth about Adolf Hitler, how he was the opposite of what we've been told. Number four is Advanced Ancient Global Civilizations. Join me on the Brian Ruse Show, Tuesday nights from 6 to 8 on Studio B on Revolution Radio.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Any commercial advertising you may hear in this program is of the sole discretion and benefit of the host of whose program you are listening to. Revolution Radio does not endorse any commercial products, nor does it accept monetary compensation for on-air advertising of commercial products, nor will it ever. We are and shall remain 100% listener supported. Any product advertising on this program are considered used at higher risk, and Revolution Radio shall not be held liable for any claims or damages received from any product advertised within this program. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps. The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates. You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Boy, have we been sold a bad pill. Jeez. We're just being doomed by commercialism, it's sad.
In 2020, Mark and I honestly thought COVID would be over by the end of that year. The story was preposterous, and clearly nothing was happening in most places around the world, apart from constant fear propaganda and a case demic brought about by the fraudulent application of the PCR. Even if people couldn't see there was no virus, the responses, mantras, and flip-flopping narratives still meant that some of the viewers were getting suspicious. Cue 2021, and it became apparent to us that the lab leak gain-of-function narrative was working overtime to keep stragglers on the plantation. I released gain-of-function gaslighting, and then in 2022, released gain-of-function garbage and bioweapon BS. We also made a response to Project Veritas earlier this year after they promoted a, quote, virus-directed evolution tale. Let's have a look at some of the latest stories ramping up the lab leak narrative and why no one can find a virus in nature.
One of the greatest things that COVID itself is a field for establishing if viruses actually existed. It's been trying to justify it since This is sensitive.
Whenever you see a story about lab leaks or engineered viruses, there might be some reference to an alleged smoking gun, whether it be in the form of a patent, an NIH grant, a Fauci email, or a photo of a top secret biolab facility. We've been over such things many times and point out to the promoters that these are not evidence of viruses or pathogens. Some go a step further and cite a scientific study with a dramatic headline. And yes, we are aware of these papers and have broken down the methodologies to show how farcical they are. No viruses and no contagion demonstrated. From what we can see, the promoters of any lab leak theory are either distracted by peripheral phenomena, unable to analyse virology papers, or are being disingenuous as they, or the organisation they work for, have a vested interest in the virus model. However, assigning motive involves speculation, and we don't need to do that to blow the story apart one more time. On the 20th of October, Children's Health Defence were at it again with fear-based narratives about lab-engineered viruses. They reported that, in his new book, Deception, The Great COVID Cover-Up, Senator Rand Paul details the catastrophic failures of the public health emergency during the pandemic. Addressing the gain-of-function research funded in part by the US government, Paul claims Dr. Anthony Fauci and his scientific yes-men not only knew the SARS-CoV-2 virus originated at China's Wuhan Institute of Virology, but worked to cover it up and attack anyone threatening to reveal the truth. You may get the feeling that many people have been deeply asleep during the past 4 years. Mention 2 weeks to flatten the curve and you'll get a blank look, even from those that dutifully repeated the foolish mantra back in 2020. Those espousing the lab leak cover-up story also seem to be missing things, or they have forgotten that in early 2020 it was one of the narratives being promulgated by the mainstream media. For example, The Sun published a story in April that year that stated, "It was revealed earlier this month ministers fear the deadly pandemic could have started after a leak from a lab. US and British intelligence officials suspect bungling scientists at the Wuhan Institute of Virology accidentally spread the killer during risky coronavirus tests on bats." The story included a map showing the proximity of the institute to the Huanan seafood market and photographs said to be from inside the facility that were openly published by China Daily, the state-run media platform. But shh, it's all top secret, folks. Then in 2021, we had the United States Senate chiming in as though there was a lab leak cover-up going on and apparently caught red-handed. Big tech platforms were now reversing the censorship.
We know that Facebook recently reversed their decision on taking down any kind of information that said it came from the lab in Wuhan.
So the overt product placement has been done since 2020 through the mainstream media, politicians and big tech. But the lab leak proponents think that this is something that the public is not supposed to know about. Lab leak nonsense has continued to be splashed across corporate media headlines in 2023. And yet somehow the likes of Rand Paul are portraying this as a high-level cover-up. One thing that has been consistent during the COVID era is the blanket censorship and suppression of the no virus arguments. I am unable to post COVID-related content on my YouTube channel, and even my video on polio was banned after just 6 minutes. For the past 4 years, my viewers have informed me that simply posting a link to one of my videos can result in a suspension of their Facebook account. Meanwhile, the proponents of the gain-of-function narratives can post links to the New York Times now. Rand Paul's entire analysis has a fatal flaw, and that is taking the virologist's claims at face value. He does not examine the methodologies being employed in virology, so he runs with words like isolation and gain-of-function to sustain the narrative that an infectious, disease-causing particle has been physically isolated and then modified to make it even more dangerous. In reality, nothing of the sort has ever been demonstrated. As well as covering the work of Ron Fouchier, Ralph Baric and Peter Daszak in videos, my husband Mark also discussed the lab leak fallacy in A Farewell to Virology, his formal refutation of the virus model. We have broken down these papers numerous times to expose their pseudoscientific nature that pervades the entire field of virology. In their promotional piece on Rand Paul, when they stated the gain-of-function research funded in part by the US government, CHD provide a link to an article by Dr. Joseph McCullough they posted on their website in April 2022. This was titled, 100,000 plus documents reveal disturbing details about high-risk gain-of-function experiments. But what exactly was it referring to? An investigative report by Vanity Fair. I kid you not. McCullough and the CHD think that Vanity Fair are going to reveal the truth about COVID-19 to the public. This wasn't the first time Vanity Fair had presented this narrative. In fact, they published a huge feature article in July 2021. If you read this article, you will see it contains nothing more than talk about people who talk about viruses. These peripheral stories about politics, grants, and government documents may be fascinating for the naive, but it is all fluff when you are looking for scientific evidence. Where is the virus? The second Vanity Fair expose, the one referred to in the McCullough CHD article, suffers from the same problem. Amongst the 100,000 plus documents, where do we find any evidence for a virus? Halfway through the article, we do see a citation. The author states that Shi Zingli and a preeminent coronavirus researcher at the University of North Carolina, Ralph Barrick, mixed components of SARS-like viruses from different species and created a novel chimera that was able to directly infect human cells. And the paper they link to is this one that appeared in Nature Medicine in 2015. A SARS-like cluster of circulating bat coronaviruses shows potential for human emergence. So this is the evidence they are presenting for virus existence and laboratory engineering of such claimed viruses. Let the dissection begin. As with any virology paper, you don't get distracted by the title or the abstract, which contain fanciful claims. You need to focus on the ticklish spot, which is the method section. Here we find it opens by stating, wild-type SARS-CoV, Urbani, mouse-adapted SARS-CoV, MA15, and chimeric SARS-like COVs were cultured on Vero E6 cells obtained from United States Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases. So right here, the whole thing falls apart. They are claiming that they already know they have viruses in the starting samples. Without establishing anything of the sort, they can then state that the culture cells were, quote, inoculated with virus. In reality, they have a mixture of culture cells, proteins and genetic sequences, along with fetal serum, some antibiotic and antifungal agents. The nonsense then gets on stilts with the section, construction of SARS-like chimeric viruses. Here they claim to be making a, quote, infectious clone by using spike sequences from their samples, along with, quote, six contiguous complementary DNAs using published sequences. Don't take your eye off the ball here. These sequences have never been shown to come from a virus. They have simply been fraudulently classified as viral on genetic data banks from processes that never physically isolated any viruses. These complementary DNA sequences were then transcribed into RNA and mixed with Vero monkey kidney cells to supposedly make viruses. So the statement that chimeric and full-length viruses were confirmed by sequence analysis before use in these studies is a case of circular reasoning. They had already declared in advance that these sequences were viral. It doesn't matter whether they were in the form of cDNA or RNA. Unfortunately, this, quote, infectious clone business has fooled a number of people who continue to ignore the provenance issue. If there is no physical isolation of any particle shown to be viral, how can it be claimed that these sequences come from inside one? So at this point, all they have are Vero cell mixtures, including various proteins and genetic sequences. To clarify, a virus is said to be a replication-competent particle consisting of a genome and a proteinaceous coat. It is supposed to be an intracellular parasite that causes disease. Anyone thinking that this has been established at this point is seeing things. The methodology is clearly insufficient to make such a claim. Their case rests on starting with samples from the US Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases, and you would have to be pretty new to this game to believe that they have ever physically isolated any viruses.
Such a sweet kid.
We then move to the next section of the Barrack study, mice and in vivo infection, where they exposed mice to their mixture that contained the imaginary viruses. Not just any mice, but highly inbred albino BALB mice. They anaesthetized the mice and then squirted 50 microliters into the nose of each mouse. This may not sound like much fluid, but by weight, it is equivalent to injecting half a cup or 4 fluid ounces into a human's nose while they are asleep. The tomfoolery continued when they stated no blinding was used in any animal experiments and animals were not randomized. They presented this chart showing weight loss and lethality after injecting the two mixtures into the mice. Because it was not a scientific study, there was no control group, and the actual lethality was apparent mostly caused by sacrifice due to the study protocols. But however they abused these animals, it was all pointless from the start, as they have not shown an infectious particle. Thus, all of their results are built on a false premise. For example, this does not represent a, quote, viral titer or infection, but levels of selected nucleic acid sequences in their in vitro cell culture experiments. The study also features some histological slides and antibody assays without valid controls again. But aside from that, they are all indirect measures that do not require the existence of viruses. So here it is, a colourful depiction. It was certainly created in a lab, but it's not a virus. Vanity Fair did not bother to analyse this paper in any way and reported that this gain-of-function experiment, which had begun prior to the moratorium, was so fraught that the authors flagged the dangers themselves, writing, "Scientific review panels may deem similar studies too risky to pursue. The only risk they are running is that more people start waking up to the fraud of virology. Instead of lab leaks that look like something out of Outbreak, they will understand that, like the film, it is pure fiction." Sadly, though, the headlines are being promulgated by Dr. McCullough, Rand Paul, and the CHD, without any of them discussing the actual science in these papers. If they are unable to understand these so-called gain-of-function experiments, then shouldn't they say, "I don't know," and leave it at that? On that front, we are often asked to talk to prominent health freedom individuals who have called fraud on various COVID responses but are still subscribing to the virus model. Almost universally, they do not want to discuss the methodologies of the virologists and start discussing peripheral phenomena. As Tom Cowan has publicly announced several times, the offer is open to walk through a virological paper step by step. At each step, we would like them to state whether they think it is following the scientific method and whether there are valid controls. We would also like them to look at a paper like the Barrack one I have just presented and indicate which part they think demonstrates the existence of a virus as defined by the virologists. Ironically, they say Fauci is lying when it comes to vaccines, drugs, and public policy, but when it comes to Fauci's basic virology, everything is spot on.
Because I represent science.
As we have explained in Virus Mania, Fauci has been one of the major drivers of establishment virology for the past 4 decades and was probably the most powerful AIDS official in the United States. Public belief in the virus model is the single most important factor, keeping the whole show together. Coming back to the title of the video, it means that there is no evidence that viruses exist in nature. Trying to find and isolate such particles directly from humans, animals, or plants failed long ago. Christine Massey has tirelessly requested this evidence from hundreds of institutions around the world, and they have all turned up a blank, not only for SARS-CoV-2, but for any alleged viruses. This point is crucial for people to understand. Viruses have never been seen in nature. They are created in laboratories, but only as fictional constructs in the imaginations of the virologists. This can be through calling particles in cell breakdown experiments viral and then blaming the breakdown on the particles, or it could be through silly experiments where mixtures are injected into animals and then the responses are attributed to imagined viruses. Or it could be through creating a, quote, genome, even though the provenance of the genetic material was not established. This latter technique is increasingly favored by virologists as it largely takes place in the dry lab, that is, on their computer simulations. None of this translates to infectious, replicating, and disease-causing particles as biological entities. Because there is no evidence that they exist, there is no evidence that there is anything contagious to leak from a lab. So what goes on in top-secret facilities is nothing to do with actual viruses. If they really had evidence for such a thing, they would have showcased it to the public long ago. Those who have studied the history of virology can see that despite their best efforts, they have a fatal problem of the missing virus. The lab leak sleuths who are mining the genetic databases and looking at government reports are not finding breadcrumbs accidentally left behind by stealthy virologists. They are finding giant loaves of bread that are designed to go along with the circus. If they looked upstream, they might notice that they are dealing with pseudoscientific constructs. Perhaps they should consider why the virologists have not done the blinded and controlled experiments that we proposed to them in the Settling the Virus debate statement. As always, I encourage everyone not to get swept up in fear narratives. The virus model has been one of the greatest tools of manipulation, and its influence has been catastrophic, particularly in the last 4 years. Many of us have learnt to ignore the model in our own lives, and the health of our families is all the better for it. If you enjoyed this video, please visit support.dsam.com.
All right, I'm a bit late to this one, but I've got the flu. Gen Z Z TikTokers suddenly discovered who Osama bin Laden was, specifically the letter to America that bin Laden wrote, reportedly as an explanation as to why he planned 9/11. They don't even really address what's in the letter. It's all,
oh, have you seen this letter? This will change your life.
First time you've heard about blowback is because of a stupid TikTok trend. Were any of these people alive after 9/11? It was Western media outlets that published this letter in the first place. Much of bin Laden's letter complains about Palestine, and that's clearly why it's gone viral again. It is possible to hold two thoughts in your head at the same time. They're not mutually exclusive. Invading foreign countries for bullshit reasons. Bad thing. Carrying out terrorist attacks which kill innocent people. Also bad thing. Unfortunately, most TikTok creators have the IQ of a mealworm, so they struggle to grasp such basic concepts.
Something like that.
Threatening nuclear war or his utter meltdown at Tucker Carlson. Who's right, who's in the wrong? Well, a good rule of thumb is generally to find out what Ben Shapiro thinks about a massive subject, then adopt the opposite opinion. Because Benny Boy tends to get the big calls badly wrong. Wrong on Trump.
Donald Trump is a liar.
Wrong on vaccines.
The vaccines are extremely effective. If you're vaxxed, you're good to go.
If you have had the vaccine, you're extremely safe.
Wrong on Ukraine.
There have been people, including Tucker Carlson, for example, who've suggested that there's a widespread crackdown on religious freedom in Ukraine.
I mean, where did he get that idea from? Ben has been spectacularly wrong on nearly every single big issue for nearly a decade. But surely we can trust him when it comes to, checks notes, World War III. Right, Ben Shapiro, never Trump, destabilized Syria, compelled vaccination, opposes J6s, Ukraine, McCarthy, mass bombings in Gaza, but lower taxes? Right. Finally, some juicy drama. At last, Ben Shapiro might have picked an argument he can't win.
Let's get ready to rumble!
This is backhand to someone. I think her behavior during this administration, her faux sophistication on these particular issues, has been ridiculous.
Wow, I haven't seen someone turn on their ally this bad since the USS Liberty incident. At first, there was radio silence from both Candace and Shapiro. But wait, what's this?
I can't respond to it on a level of intellect because there's nothing that he has expressed, in that, at least in that short clip, that he fundamentally disagrees with in terms of what I said. I'm not going to respond with the same ad hominem attacks. Yep. I would be embarrassed. So I think that the video speaks more to Ben's character than it speaks to mine.
She pretty much took the high ground, so maybe you're thinking that was the end of it. Oh, no. Been acting unprofessional and emotionally unhinged for weeks now. We've all had to sit back and allow it and have all tried to exercise exceeding understanding for your raw emotion. You, Candace, basically accusing Ben of allowing feelings to dominate his facts. Alright, calm down, mate. Not as if you just completed a stunning upset all-the-odds comeback to win a national election, is it? Wait, you did!
Javier Milei has promised a new dawn.
Almost 40 years of leftist rule finally abolished. Having lost the first round of voting, Javier Milei roared back to beat his opponent by more than 10%, completely confounding all the polls that said he would lose, leaving his rival supporters blubbering like Hillary Clinton voters in 2016.
Politico, social y economico.
The media calls him a far-right outsider, yet Javier Milei calls himself a libertarian anarcho-capitalist. Those two things are quite distinctly not the same. Everyone calls him El Loco, the madman. Can't quite fathom why. His dead dog told him to run for president. The so-called Argentinian Trump has vowed to make Argentina great again. Base! Just like Trump, he's a TV celebrity turned political campaigner. So who is Javier Milei and what does he actually believe in? Well, he's not shy about telling you.
Al zurdo de mierda no le podés dar ni un milímetro.
Pero me puede definir zurdo de mierda, que no.
Todos los que, digamos, los colectivistas, los que ponen, digamos, o sea, esa idea. A ver,
¿por qué le pones de mierda, digamos?
Porque son una mierda.
¿Veis?
O sea, si, clas...
No, pero es que si pensás,
pero no, pero digo,
pero si pensás distinto te van a aniquilar. Ese es el punto. Es decir, vos al zurdo no le podés dar un milímetro, porque le das un milímetro y lo toma para destrozarte.
¿Veis?
¡Zurdos, hijos de puta, tiemblen! ¡La libertad avanza! ¡Viva la libertad, carajo!
¿Veis?
Ministerio de Cultura, afuera. Ministerio de Ambiente y Desarrollo Sostenible, afuera. Ministerio de las Mujeres y Género y Diversidad, afuera. Ministerio de Obras Públicas, afuera. Aunque te resistas.
¿Veis?
Ministerio de Educación. Adoctrinamiento, afuera. Se acabó el curro de la política. ¡Viva la libertad, carajo!
¡Ey!
Zurdos, hijos de puta, ahí tienen. ¡Las pelotas voy a pedir, Estado!
¡Ey!
¿Sabes qué es? La bandera anarcocapitalista, ¿sí? La bandera de los liberales libertarios. Negro tiene que ver con la anarquía.
¿Veis? Cringe.
Libertario, la anarquía.
Cringe.
Es decir, esta es una sociedad que está infectada.
Radio at freedomslips.com. We'll be right back after this message.
Find some comfort at Willow's World. A variety of news, commentary, and poetry at Willow's Poetry Corner, where there are comfy cushions and a tempting selection of delectable comestibles. A show that's quirkily and quintessentially British, with a unique twist. Featuring Willow Andreasen, your host. Join Willow, Mondays and Thursdays, 2 till 4 p.m. Eastern Time, Studio A.
Join me and the Brian Ruse Show on Revolution Radio, Eastern Standard Time, every Tuesday night from 6 to 8. We talk about the four most vital things, in my view, affecting all of humanity. Number one is UFOs and aliens and their agenda for the advancement of humanity. Number two is the Jewish establishment's control over all aspects of human civilization. Number three, the truth about Adolf Hitler, how he was the opposite of what we've been told. Number four is advanced ancient global civilizations. Join me on the Brian Ruse Show, Tuesday nights from 6 to 8 on Studio B on Revolution Radio.
Thank you.
interested in the paranormal? Murder mystery? Real natural law? Do you enjoy interviews with amazing guests? Then join Crip Rick every Monday night, 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, right here on Revolution Radio. Studio A, freedomslips.com. Crip Rick's iPhone, thank you. Welcome to the Crypt.
Join me at Revolution Radio, Studio B, at 11 a.m. on Saturday for Free Association, when we take a look at philosophy, spirituality, psychology, social issues, and geopolitics. It's every Saturday at 11 a.m. Eastern on Studio B at freedomslips.com.
Hey everyone, it's Barbara Jean Lindsay, the Cosmic Oracle. If you have questions about your past lives or future plans, need answers from the cosmos about your love life or career, or just want to keep your finger on the pulse of the planet, check out my show, The Cosmic Oracle, here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com.
I want to thank everybody for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, the one place where information never sleeps. Revolution, Revolution Radio!
All right, let's show them what we got here.
We now return to Revolution Radio's very own feral hippie,
Mona Radler.
Thank you all for joining us here at freedomslips.org, revolution.radio. It is the 20th day of November, 2023. We are listener supported, so please do us that favor. Come to the home page and do a donate click. We truly will appreciate it. Thank you very much. Really. Thank you very much. Biblical ranks at the United Arabs. It's not any more flooding than normal places. We're really getting into the stories, aren't we? Alright, the streets are flooding. It's heavy raining. Maybe because of the desert, you know what I mean? I don't know why they say biblical. I mean, I'd watch out.
I'm not going to come at all.
The worst flood in the United largest city in recent years. Rainfall was at a record high.
Record high rain.
I want to buy your house. I can pay you cash for your house, no matter what condition it's in. Do you own?
More than 40 millimeters of rainfall.
Moving pretty fast. Buses and cars are semi up to the bottom. Not really. Like, you know, they're not submerged too much.
Residents were advised to avoid beaches and stay home.
But your wipers are on full. You make a wake when you drive through. Yeah, you can. I don't see any cars floating there.
Residents have been posting videos on social media showing cars floating in the water.
Oh, now that she says there are. Winter, they're all out of power. A lot of cars are ruined, though.
Flood damage could take months to repair.
Yeah.
The expansion of the city has reduced the national catchment area, causing water to spill into the city.
Yeah, it looks a little heavy on the water. Getting into buildings and basements. How do you make a basement in the sand?
This is one of the worst floods in the Emirates' largest city in recent years.
Definitely overflowing.
Rainfall was at a record high.
People are still traveling through it.
More than 40 millimeters of rain fell.
I feel for all the ruined cars.
Residents were advised to avoid beaches and stay home.
No doubt. Avoid the beaches.
Traffic and flights were affected due to the weather conditions.
Everything's like closed.
Residents have been posting videos on social media showing cars floating in the water. The first floor and basement of buildings were flooded.
Yep.
Flood damage could take months to repair.
Maybe. Yeah, you don't want to get caught in that runoff.
The expansion of the city has reduced the natural catchment area, causing water to spill into the sea.
I am a primary care physician. I'm frustrated, and it is not what I signed up for.
Yeah, well, I don't like the ads in between the videos, but I still have to deal with it.
Extreme weather conditions continue to impact the Arabia Peninsula. This is one of the worst floods in the Emirates' largest city in recent years. Rainfall was at a record high. more than 40 millimeters of rainfall.
It's not saying if the electric's on or not. Probably not.
Traffic and flights were affected due to the weather conditions. Residents have been posting videos on social media showing cars floating in the water. The first floor and basement of buildings were flooded.
More than one everywhere.
It takes months to repair.
Yeah.
The expansion of the city has reduced the natural catchment area, causing water to spill into the sea.
Well, they're going to wait for it to all go into the ocean, huh? Guess they don't have a choice.
This weird, flexible orange tool is...
You know, the one experiment a lot of people have heard about is they've heard about Montauk, right? And Montauk was used for mind control. And what you're seeing here in this picture is called the SAGE radar system. And what they were doing with this system is they figured out that when they changed the rate of the electromagnetic pulse aimed at a human body and a brain, they could alter their thoughts, they could alter what they feel, and ultimately they could alter what they do altogether. They could influence their actions, and they could actually hack into their brain so that they began to, you know, create what they were being stimulated to see. And there's this famous thing called the Montauk chair, right? There's tales of, you know, when people were sitting in the Montauk chair, they actually had to tear down the factory, because what happened is that one of the guys in the chair manifested this monster, and they had to destroy everything because it was like in the wild, right? So all of this stuff has to do with what they've figured out in terms of frequency. But the real crux of all of this, and the reason all of this works, has to do with, you know, something called wave structured matter. And, you know, here's a picture of something called the double slit experiment, which a lot of people have heard about. What is a double slit experiment? What did it prove? Well, it proved in a nutshell that waves become particles when they're observed. So this was the formula of how we as conscious human beings manifest our reality, right? And it ties right into, here's a diagram of what they call in and out waves colliding to make standing waves. And wherever they collide, like what happens is waves move to the middle, and the ones that are from the middle that were there before, they have no place else to go. So they turn around and go back out. And when they collide with the incoming waves, they create what's called standing waves. And according to this model of the universe, it's the standing waves, which is kind of the tipping point where we actually, our senses pick up the structure. So we think that what we're seeing is the real thing, but what we're not seeing is the puppet master behind physical matter, which is outside, which is in hyperspace, which is scalar wave material, which is beyond space and time. So the information stored in the field outside is when it collides, when our thoughts, in other words, begin to interact. It's a feedback loop. And the way, and this is something I talk about again, shameless plug in Inner Looking Glass, but the way it works is that we are in a feedback loop between when we respond to what's coming at us in an organic, from an organic timeline, and we give back, and it gets the interface between hyperspace and matter is the electron. And so what that diagram showed you was kind of the model of an electron. And that's where the information is actually stored. And so what they figured out is they figured out that they could hack that. They could hack into that space. In fact, they didn't figure it out. This is what's been going on, but they figured out how it's done, right?
That's what Harari basically, that's what he said. And he said, Harari, remember that clip where he said,
yeah,
we're hacking the human. What he was really saying, and he didn't, because he didn't want to say, they're hacking consciousness. That's what they're really wanting to hack. It's consciousness.
Yes.
That's the game. That's the name of the, that's what they want to do.
Right, right. And so you have things like, this is like the U.S., this is from the official U.S. Defense Department science blog, right? It says essentially remote control of brain activity using ultrasound, right? It says, quote, every aspect of human sensation, perception, emotion, and behavior is regulated by brain activity. Thus having the ability to stimulate brain function is a powerful technology, right? So, and there's a link there if you guys want to check that out. And here's a few recent flashes of information that I've been sent: cognitive computing, brain machine interactions, and the enhanced warfighter, right? This is what they're working on, like the dual use implications of advances in brain science, how to induce fear, depression, suicidal ideation, aggression, disruption of sleep patterns through chemical and electronic modulation. This is what they're into, right? And I'm, one of our shows, I showed you something called brain transparency, which is what the World Economic Forum, they had a presentation at the last event where somebody came up on the stage, the scientist, and said essentially, well, you know, this is all technology that we've had for quite some time. And they ran a little simulated like cartoon about how the person sitting at the desk, which is the one you see in that picture, was worried because their brain patterns were being picked up by the monitor in front of them and regulated and monitored by their superiors. And then in the end of that cartoon, the CIA comes in and they bust one of the, you know, her colleagues, because they found his brain patterns were emulating the brain patterns of somebody who had been ripping off the company. So they escort him out of the building. So.
And the cool thing was, though, that the presenter asked the audience kind of after the clip ran, isn't that cool? Isn't that great? That's the future.
No.
And even at the World Economic Forum, even the NPCs at the World Economic Forum were like, no.
Exactly. Exactly. Right. You know, so this is it. This is how it works, you know, and essentially what they've got is they've got these brain computer interfaces, and it emulates the process signal acquisition, because essentially what they've realized is that the human biofield is another body part, and the human biofield has a particular frequency, and they can acquire the signal and they can process the signal, they can change it, and they can put it into applications, and they can feed it back. And then, so what we were talking about with the synchronicity is demonstrated by that diagram, right? And, you know, they've taken it further to the point now where they're building models of in an artificial universe. So they're now beyond just electrical stimulation. They're actually effectively working on complex creation models of artificial universes based on metaphors, right? So they're giving people things to, you know, whatever, to imagine, and they're giving people the things to dream of, right? To, you know, to fantasize over, and they're registering their emotional reaction to it, and they're using that to create the input for you to then, you know, go and create your universe. Because what are we, right? We're powerful creative beings. And these beings, one thing they can't do is they cannot create. They're barred from our sensory experience in the real organic timeline. And so the only way they can utilize it is they can manipulate us so that we experience things for them, mostly fear oriented. And it's all about control. This is all about control. Ultimately, this is where it's going, because you got to ask yourself, like, look, if this isn't about control, then why are most of the things that you see out there in the public negative?
You deserve the truth, but big tech does not want you to hear it. So we built our own Inspired platform on theinspiredchannel.com. To watch the full video and more, just click the link in the video description or the pinned
a
general statement. Silence is not an option. This totally pertains to you, your world, and everybody else out there. There has been a campaign over the last years of social pressure through all levels of society where self-censorship has been the result of this. Self-censorship is when you actually want to say something, but then you go, oh, I don't know what that person might think. Oh, I'm going to get criticized over this. Oh, I'm going to get judged. Oh, I'm going to get shut down. Oh, they're not going to take it well. They might be offended, all that, right? Situations where I would encourage you to not go into a confrontational conversation. And the predominant situation would be when somebody's stupid. It's not worth it, trust me. But then when you're talking to an intelligent person, somebody who has insight, critical thinking, the ability to analyze, and you do not speak up when you have something to say, that's true self-censorship. And that creates a whole array of problems that we're seeing in the world today. We are not saying anything because oftentimes intelligent people could be also people that are easily offended, and that is wrong. It should never be an option. And right now, in this critical stage that we're in, silence simply is not an option. You have to speak up when you have something to say. And if you know that you are speaking facts and truth, you have to own that too. That's really important. It's not to persuade the other person, but for that to be heard, because otherwise it gets drowned out. And for the truth to disappear is simply for it to not be spoken anymore. It's like when people go on a show or on a podcast or on a TV and they say, yeah, yeah, sure, there's maybe 37 genders or 72 genders. No, there are an infinite numbers of ways of how people can feel about themselves. And honestly, there's nothing you should really do about it. However someone feels about themselves, if they don't want to change anything, well, it's up to them. But by you playing their game, you create a space for this to become accepted, and that everybody needs to adjust to their viewpoint or to how they feel about themselves. And this simply, historically speaking, this is not how humanity lives. You accept that people are different. You accept that people live different lifestyles. But that doesn't mean that you adjust yours so they can feel better about theirs. That's stupid, right? So I'm taking this gender example because it's becoming such a huge thing. So if somebody walks up to your door, let's say a UPS driver, and he delivers a package, and obviously it's a guy, and you say, thank you, sir. I say, no, 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 I'm not a human being, I'm a monkey. Will you actually address that dude as a monkey? No, no, you wouldn't. I mean, you're not stupid, you're smart, you wouldn't address him as a monkey. The pushback is slowly starting to be felt now in the public arena, because for years, people that have had, let's say, more common sense views or fact-driven views, they've allowed themselves to be pushed back more and more and more and more and more to the point where they simply weren't saying anything. Because I don't want to rock the boat. There's no need to have a confrontation here. There's no need to do any of this. But then the other people who are projecting their mental illness on society are putting this into laws, and they're putting this into mandates, into regulations. Now you have a whole different set of problems. It starts where within your family, you don't feel comfortable speaking up anymore. Within your friendship group, you don't feel comfortable speaking up anymore. Around your colleagues, you don't feel comfortable speaking up anymore. Because if you don't go with the flavor of the week, there is a cancel agenda that's out there. So everybody who's not going with the game is getting canceled. I would suggest that the group of people that are getting canceled are much bigger than the other group, just in sheer numbers. But also, do you really want to participate in a society that is completely banning free speech, completely banning free expression, completely banning your right to say what you think? And I can't tell you how often bright, beautiful, intelligent people have said to my face, I'm not having any conversations anymore. I'm not speaking to anybody. I'm not saying anything because I'm afraid. Well, in war, the first thing that dies is the truth. Are you willing? Are we really willing to let that happen? The pursuit of truth. It's good and well that the alternative media space has grown and that more and more voices come up that share different perspectives and are not afraid to speak up. But if the people in everyday conversations, everywhere in coffee shops, in grocery stores, in restaurants, around the Thanksgiving table, if they are not willing to respectfully share their thoughts, views, and opinions, then this will escalate very quickly into a hellhole situation. It has, in some instances, already happened. So don't argue with stupid people. That's useless. But other than that, don't hold back. Don't let yourself be silenced. Free speech is literally what allowed this part of the world to experience some of the worst things that you could experience, but also some of the best things you could experience. It's all because there's still an idea of freedom that is being kept alive. When did we become so afraid to say what we think? What made that happen? And here I'll give you one last example. And I would never say this about myself because I don't view the world this way, but I'll say it just to make a point. I'm a proud white guy. Now, think about it. You say I'm a proud black man, that's okay. You say I'm a proud Asian man, that's okay. I'm a proud Indian man, that's okay. But can you say I'm a proud white man without being super racist? Where does that come from? All I'm trying to make is a point. This is perceptual programming because white man bad. It's perceptual programming. You can go and build a whole brand, a lifestyle, an empire on the statement, I'm a proud black man, and celebrate it every day and always. But you can't do the same thing by saying I'm a proud white man. And to me, that would be stupid anyways. Why would I differentiate in appearance, in color of skin? I'm just saying this is how programming works. This is how one viewpoint is accepted over another viewpoint that is completely unaccepted, saying the exact same thing. Just wanted to bring that up. All right, friends.
Revolution Radio, Studio B, at 11 a.m. on Saturday for free association, when we take a look at philosophy, spirituality, psychology, social issues, and geopolitics. It's every Saturday at 11 a.m. Eastern on Studio B at freedomslips.com.
Transcending time and space, let us take you to the place inside your mind where thoughts divide and mysteries unwind. Join us every Monday evening right here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time, and you will catch the Fenton Perspective with our great host, Lorian Fenton. Come listen in as she shares her amazing stories from the past to present, along with all of her guest secrets to the future. That's the Fenton Perspective every Monday evening right here from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time, only on Revolution Radio. Oh, and you don't need to expect us. We're already here.
We're already here.
That the Capitol will ever treat us fairly. You are lying to yourselves. Because we know who they are and what they do. This is what they do, and we must fight back. You can torture us and bomb us. Fire is catching. And if we burn, you burn with us.
Good evening.
Are you awake yet? I hope. We've tried and we've tried for years and years to use passive resistance and loud voices to make a change. The time is over. Your governments around the world have no other goal than to decimate your entire existence. At the hands of the bankers and the elites. The war is coming, and it's your choice to decide if you want to be a warrior or a victim. Denial is not a choice anymore. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet. Not giving up. Revolution Radio.
All right. Thanks for listening while we take that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And now we're going to get back to your host.
Okay. Right. Why not? Well, because this is just, I gotta see this. They're saying the graphite oxide got to them. Crashes to the ground, trying to figure out what's the matter with him. He falls backwards and ends up dead. Huh. Is he a lucky one or not? Sad. What did they do? Well, 5G? How did they? I don't know. We know. Flipping outcome of a lot of this stuff, which is even sadder yet.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the channel. We had an interesting ruling out of a U.S. District Court this week, and that is that a judge found, under Bruin, that banning someone from owning a gun for the rest of their lives over a drunk driving conviction is unconstitutional. That's not to say that drunk driving isn't terrible, because it is, or that guns and alcohol mix, because they don't. But it's certainly an interesting turn of events under Bruin. The case was brought by Edward A. Williams, who was convicted for drunk driving about 20 years ago. He was sentenced to 90 days to 2 years, which he was allowed to serve at home due to a medical issue. In 2017, he filed suit to try and get his rights back, saying it was unconstitutional for him to lose his rights over a nonviolent misdemeanor conviction. He lost. I am assuming at this point that he is sober, or else that would be really ballsy to try to take this back to court. Recently, he joined with Firearms Policy Coalition and tried again under Bruin, which also leads me to believe that he is sober now because I don't think that they would be putting their butts on the line otherwise. On Tuesday, U.S. District Court Judge John Milton Young ruled in his favor. He wrote, "In no way does the court dispute the dangerousness of drunk driving or of combining firearm use and alcohol consumption, and it acknowledges that plaintiff's offenses were serious and his conduct during his convictions in 2004 and 2005 dangerous. However, that legislatures have historically labeled certain groups and conduct dangerous for the purposes of disarmament does not, in and of itself, create a historical analog to the present-day prohibition on firearm possession by those convicted of DUIs." The Range Court had rejected the argument that status-based restrictions on dangerous groups identified as such by the legislature would constitute an appropriate analogy to Section 922 G1 today, noting that legislatures are not empowered to eviscerate the general right to publicly carry arms for self-defense with overbroad categorizations. Historical regulations on persons deemed dangerous do not present a sufficient historical analog without showing that the regulated conduct itself is analogous to plaintiffs. The judge in that Colorado case video that I did the other day should probably check this out. Anyways, similarly, the court finds the government's argument that Section 922 G1 can be appropriately applied to plaintiff because of historical regulations on the possession of a firearm by a presently intoxicated person unavailing. The government points to several regulations permitting the disarmament of drunk or intoxicated persons. None of these regulations allude to disarmament lasting beyond the individual's state of intoxication, and none provided for permanent disarmament, as Section 922 G1 does. Certainly, this court agrees that using a firearm while intoxicated is dangerous, but historical regulations which momentarily disarmed certain individuals for temporary mental incapacity cannot be considered similar to the sanction of permanent disarmament for past DUI convictions. As noted in Range, government confiscation of the instruments of crime, including to prevent an imminent crime, differs from a status-based lifetime ban on firearm possession. As stated in Bruin, the court must consider the how and why behind Second Amendment restrictions to determine whether the modern articulation is relevantly similar to its proposed historical analog. The language in the regulations offered by the government suggests an interest in protecting the public from an inevitable danger caused by allowing a presently intoxicated person to use a firearm. Section 922 G1's prohibition on firearm possession for those convicted of a DUI cannot, without significant speculation by the court, be considered as having a substantially similar purpose. In the end, Judge Young concluded, "The government has not carried its burden in proving that the United States tradition of firearm regulation supports stripping an individual of their right to possess a firearm because they had previously driven while intoxicated. The application of Section 922 G1 to plaintiff, therefore, constitutes a violation of his Second Amendment rights, and the court finds that plaintiff is entitled to the requested relief." I am sure that the government is going to be appealing this one, but it's going to be an interesting and fun one to watch for all kinds of reasons. Feels a little bit like we got some Bruin Wild West going on here. And I'm sure that the legacy media will paint it as such, like in the worst possible way. So I will be keeping track of any developments on this case. You guys know all the stuff for the algorithm. I don't have to tell you every time. You know the drill. And as always, thanks for tuning in and happy shooting.
Okay, welcome back. Just give it 30 seconds here for YouTube to let everyone into the stream a second. Okay, great. So let's kick off then. This is the second video of the day. The first one was all about San Francisco and Xi and the homeless crisis and how they cleared everything in 24 hours and what Biden said and all that. So if you haven't watched it, you can watch the replay of that. We're now going to talk about some quite interesting developments then. Today, this video will be on central bank digital currencies. What has just happened, which is a little bit suspicious if you ask me, and including the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, doing a speech on central bank digital currencies, even though they've said they're nothing to do with these CBDCs. It's, you know, each country is independent, has their own sovereign, you know, all this sort of stuff, nothing to do with this. And well, wait till we get through the video. They've just issued a handbook on how to do CBDCs correctly and a keynote speech and all sorts of other things. Pretty weird. So let's go over to the shared screen then. Here we go. So this was a keynote that just took place yesterday at the Singapore FinTech Festival by Kristalina Georgieva, who is the CEO, notice the title, Chief Executive Officer of a for-profit organization. So here we go then. I come in the footsteps of my predecessor, Christine Lagarde, convicted criminal, excuse me, who 5 years ago gave a speech here encouraging policymakers to follow the winds of change and embark on a digital money voyage by exploring the use of central bank digital currencies or CBDCs and fintech. 5 years on, I'm here to provide an update on that voyage. I have four main messages. First, countries did set sail. Many are investigating CBDCs and are developing regulation to guide digital money developments. Again, CBDCs are central bank digital currencies. They're these new things that we've been talking about for a few years now. They're going to launch. They are a form of digital slavery on the people, or at least they are potentially that. Second, she says, we have not yet reached land. Okay. Third, this is not the time to turn back. So she's already setting the stage for what she wants to achieve here. We've left port and are now on the high seas. This calls for courage and determination. Does it really? I thought this was just something that countries were looking into. It's, you know, if they want to do it, it's up to them. But she's now leading by saying courage, determination. If anything, we need to raise another sail to pick up speed. Oh yeah, and why exactly is that? Is it because the Great Reset is not going as well as they hoped? Yes, I think that's the reason. Now, they have just released a virtual handbook. You can see it was just updated in November. So they've released this for central banks around the world. And you can even contact them. You can even, there's an email address here. You can even email them. I mean, this is the absurdity of it. They're nothing to do with it, nothing to do with us. But by the way, we've made a handbook to help you to launch them. Now, I'll tell you what's a bit weird about this whole thing. If you look at the AtlanticCouncil.org's tracker, it shows you who's actually launched. We've talked about Nigeria and the craziness of that. In fact, let me show you the latest update on Nigeria. The Naira scarcity worsens as banks limit withdrawals. ATMs run dry. You can see it here. ATMs have run dry. This is not going well at all in Nigeria. But let me tell you what I think is a bit weird about this. Here we go. If you look at this, which is an independent body, it's not like the Atlantic Council. This is an independent body. This has been launched. And this is from the Human Rights Council. You can see the logo at the top here from the Human Rights Council. We're going to talk about them in a second and how they're fighting against it. Now, I want to show you. Notice I've clicked launched here so we can see it in red. Here's the same thing. We've got this. We've got Nigeria. But they have something very different. They have Russia. They have China. They have India, the BRICS nations. They have them already having launched their CBDC. Now, this is not what the official narrative says. It actually says that these are still in pilot. So this is very interesting indeed that the Human Rights Foundation is claiming that they have already officially launched. Now, the other one is Thailand and Cambodia. Thailand, one of my favorite countries. I like Cambodia as well. So that's interesting. I don't think it's going to work too well, though, in these countries because people just don't trust the government there. And I know that, or let me put that a different way. They are not going to trust their monies in the bank. They want to use cash. It's a very cash-heavy country. So I just can't see it. It's a bit like Nigeria, a very heavy cash-centered country. And we'll talk, if we have time over the next week, we'll talk about what's happened in Spain as well and the pushback that we are seeing there. But from speaking to friends in Thailand, they haven't noticed any difference at all with this launch of the CBDC. Now, let's go on to the Human Rights Foundation. And by the way, if you're in any of those countries, please let me know if what's actually going on with your launch, if you've been affected in any way. But let's go on to the Human Rights Foundation. This is from Forbes. And they've now joined the fight against CBDCs.
Whoa.
So this is going to get very interesting indeed. So how CBDCs will impact the civil liberties and human rights of people living under authoritarian regimes, which is exactly what I was talking about before. Sure, it's fine, I guess we could say, in theory, to launch a CBDC in a Western nation where, well, again, I don't even think it's fine in theory, but let's just pretend and go along with that. But look what happens if you do become an authoritarian regime or you end up with someone who becomes a dictator. How on earth is that going to work? The people are going to be programmed with everything. And it even talks about it here. The Human Rights Foundation points out that 46% of the world's population lives under autocratic governments currently experimenting with CBDCs. That includes Belarus, China, Iran, Russia, Saudi Arabia, Thailand, and Turkey. CBDCs have not launched with much success. Even in autocratic countries, adoption and use rates have been dismal. Nigeria, for instance, restricted cash withdrawals to push citizens into using its CBDC. I said this as well a few months back when I did the video on it, resulting in citizens protesting cash shortages. Even after a year of restricting alternative payments, the Nigerian CBDC adoption increased to only 6% of the population. So I guess that's a good thing in some ways if it was, because there's a few countries now whose CBDC has failed. They had to abandon it. If we look at the cancelled, one of them was Ecuador. Another one was Senegal. We also have some that are inactive. We have Iceland, Kuwait, Eritrea, and North Korea. Not the best examples here, I know, Bermuda. But you can see that some of these are now inactive. Costa Rica, Uruguay. We don't know who's using it. And this is the reason why. The Bank of International Settlements. Again, we're completely independent. We're nothing to do with any government, really. Well, this is what this man said. We don't know who's using a $100 bill today. And we don't know who's using a 1,000 peso bill today. The key difference with the CBDC is the central bank will have absolute control on the rules and regulations that will determine the use of that expression of central bank liability. And also, we will have the technology to enforce that. Now, the IMF's Deputy Managing Director, here we go, CEO Managing Director, what does that tell you? Bowley, CBDC can allow government agencies and private sector players to program targeted policy functions. They said it in black and white there, targeted policy functions by programming a CBDC. Money, which is it's not money, can be precisely targeted for what people can own and what people can do. They've told you, all these people that think, oh, you know, you just, you know, scaremongering and all this other stuff. No, they're telling you. They're actually, they're speaking. It's coming out of their mouth what they are planning to do with all of this. And they say it's because no one wants cash anymore. That's one of their main reasons. When more than one in eight UK bank branches is set to close this year, I mean, that is a staggering amount, one in eight. Even though they are lying again, UK cash use grows for the first time in a decade. So the cash use is actually growing. It's growing at a decent rate, not a huge rate, but branch numbers are also falling. More than 600 banks due to close by the end of 2023, leaving about 4,000 across the UK. But remember, that's on top of all the closures that happened 2020, 2021, 2022. You think how many branches there were before? Huge amounts of branches, absolutely enormous amount of branches. And look what we've got now. It's getting less and less and less. So they're just making all this stuff up as they go along. And I'm starting to question now this Atlantic Council and all the information they've been giving out, because it looks as though there are CBDCs that have been launched, Russia, China, India, and they're the BRICS countries. So I think it's very, very interesting. I'm going to definitely look into it. I've already read their IMF handbook, which was not great, not useful. But look, they're telling us exactly, even though they're private companies, CEOs, managing director, they're private companies, they're telling everybody, they're telling us, they're making it public what they think of this whole situation. They are the ones dictating or advising governments, central banks, which in fact they're not even governments, they're central banks, many of which, or a lot of which, are owned by private shareholders. So what have you got? You've got government policy allowing private companies and private individuals to influence others, where there's obviously financial incentives involved, over the citizens' bank accounts and the citizens' ability to use money. I mean, you can't make this stuff up, but it is one of those things that people ask me, but Neil, what on earth can we even do about it? You know, I'm just one person, I'm just one man, I'm just one lady. What on earth do we even do about it? And this is where the real challenge comes in. It's not as if you can protest and close your bank account, because they're closing everyone's bank accounts anyway. I was reading an article earlier today where they're talking about how the banks are closing people's accounts who are not profitable to the bank. Now, this shouldn't be allowed. I don't even know if that's legal. But then they say, oh, well, you know, KYC, know your customer, and AML, anti-money laundering. We don't know how this person makes their money. Oh, they went over to China. Oh, they took a trip to Russia. Oh, this is a bit suspicious. We don't know if they're doing something dodgy with their money. I've seen also, I get emails every day. I'm seeing all sorts of strange things at the moment. Even business bank accounts being closed down, but personal bank accounts, credit cards being closed down. So it's not as if you can even protest it by closing your account, because you're limited. It's a monopoly, especially in the UK and not as much in the US. You've got a lot of credit unions and things, but in the UK, it's a monopoly. You've got the big banks and they pretty much have this big group in. They control most of the banks. It's absolutely crazy. Just looking at the comments as we're going through here. Yeah, I mean, it's mad the way everything's going right now. It really is. All you can do is take care of yourself, take care of your family, and you really gotta think about these things. I was just writing an article today for the private community on Patreon, all about preparedness. And the more I was writing, the more I was really realizing how difficult this is now. And it really is difficult, because I was thinking, okay, well, let's focus on Maslow hierarchy of needs, and let's look at the basics that every human needs, and let's look at the challenges we know that are coming in the future. Okay, well, if we look at those challenges, we then need to do this, we need to do that. And it was like getting so complicated, because I was like, okay, now I've got the Great Reset, we've got the Great Taking, it's mad. I don't think anyone has ever had a challenge as difficult as it is for, I don't mean it like challenge as in, you know, if you think like the French Revolution or something like that, I don't mean it to that scale, or when in medieval times people, you know, an army would sack a town or something like that. But I mean, we've never had a challenge like this in terms of the complexity of our financial system now, the complexity of the debt burdens that we have, like the US debt burden and the amount of debt they are creating all the time at a rapid rate is so crazy that it defies belief that they are even doing it. It really does. All right, I think I'm going to wrap up there, and then I'll see you tomorrow for the weekly walk and talk from Lisbon. Yes, I am in Lisbon, Portugal. So we'll do a walk and talk tomorrow, which will be very interesting in this area. So apart from that, I'll see you then. Take care. God bless you. God bless your family. I'll see you tomorrow.
What is different between...
Well, there is no difference. There's a minute left. I hope everybody's Monday is a safe and profitable one with whatever you're doing, however it's going.
Natural law. Do you enjoy interviews with amazing guests? Then join Fripp Rick every Monday night, 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, right here on Revolution Radio. Studio A, freedomslips.com. Fripp Rick's hyphen, thank you. Welcome to the crypt.
Join me and the Brian Ruse Show on Revolution Radio, Eastern Standard Time, every Tuesday night from 6 to 8. We talk about the four most vital things, in my view, affecting all of humanity. Number one is UFOs and aliens and their agenda for the advancement of humanity. Number two is the Jewish establishment's control over all aspects of human civilization. Number three, the truth about Adolf Hitler, how he was the opposite of what we've been told. Number four is Advanced Ancient Global Civilizations. Join me on the Brian Ruse Show, Tuesday nights from 6 to 8 on Studio B on Revolution Radio.
Hello, my name is Mr. Rowe. I am the host of Reality Extraction, Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. I utilize logic, intellect, and magic to methodically autonomize, vivisect, analyze, examine, study, scrutinize, and extract an essence of reality from a fog of illusion and confusion. You can find me on...